sources. Okay. What are the issues that one could have? What are the sugyas involved with these issues? And again, I have no intention of going through 80 pages of Makaros with you. I have every intention of trying to show you everything here so you can learn them on your own. And I'll point out what I would call the highlights. Okay? So let's start with page one. The Gemara Nida reminds us about how Kate says Bodekas is Atzma. How does a woman check herself? And the Gemara goes through exactly how one does it. But what's key in this Gemara are the pieces that I'll mention to you, the last three lines, and the last four lines, the last three words on the fourth line, or the Benemenes Isha Lomar Maki Yeshli B'Makor Shemimena Dam Yotze. You know what? It's during my clean days, and the only reason why I'm bleeding now is because I have some type of a maka. And Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Omer, Da Maka Habam in a Makor Tame. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says, Da Maka, that comes from the Makor, that comes from the place in which creates Nidus, namely the uterus, is Tame. But Rabbi Senu Hiidu Da Maka Habam in a Makor Shehu Tar, that it's Tahar. And now you have the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch says, starts off with a case of im yesh maka ba'oso makom tolin v'dam makasa. If there's a maka in the uterus area, you're tola that it's from dam maka. V'im dam makasa mishunim v'dam riyasa. If the dam maka, the dam of injury, is different than dam that's coming from menstruation, ain't a tola v'dam makasa. But by the way, just as a practical thing, it's an important thing to know. Many times you'll be able to check, although this should not be the final decision, whether the blood is uterine blood or dam maka, simply by the color of it. Uterine blood is normally much darker. If you remember the pictures of the uterus I just showed you, the uterus travels, the blood from the uterus travels through the uterus and then travels to the vaginal area. On the way down, it picks up debris, right? It's like the rains in Teaneck, when you watch them go down the street. It starts off very clean, the water, and then it goes 2 inches, and then all of a sudden the rain picks up all the dirt, and it looks a totally different color. If it is on the out, if the blood is bright red, normally that blood came from the vaginal area. Now, I'm not saying that you should use that as a halachic compass, but when you see that, it's enough to tell the person, why don't you go speak to the OBGYN or the nurse, to see, this seems like it's dam maka, why don't you check it out if it's bright red blood? Bright red blood is normally an indication that it's not uterine blood. Now, v'choza the Rama, v'isha sheyesh lo veses kavua, v'az yucholim litlo shloz b'shas vesta b'makasa. This is talking about a woman who has a veses kavua, and she bleeds not during the time she's expected to bleed. You're told a dam maka. Even though you're not sure, 100% sure that the maka is taking the blood. However, im ein la veses kavua, what if there's no veses kavua? For who suffek im hadam ba min hamakar o min hatzadim, you're not sure. There's two svekas. One is, where did the blood come from? Did it come from the uterus or did it come from somewhere else? And there is a maka. Talina ba maka, you say that it came from the maka because mikoach svek sveka. Suffek min hatzadim o min hamakar. Maybe the blood came from a place not in the uterus. It came from the vaginal area. And even if it came from the uterus, maybe it came from the maka. If you know for sure it came from the maka, you know it came from the uterus. Even though there is an injury in the maka, in the uterus, in a tola b'maka, you can't tola b'maka, there's only one suffek. If she doesn't have a veses kavua. Unless you know for sure that the maka is expelling or the maka is creating an ooze of blood. By the way, this Rama is not agreed by all the Rishonim. The Rama is quoting Rishonim, but the Rashba, for example, on the next page doesn't agree with that. The Rashba says, if you look on the second page, and you have in the right-hand column where I have the words underlined twice, you can read it on your own. He says there clearly that that's not true. If you know that there's a maka in the makar, you can be tola it, that it comes from there, even if you're not sure if the maka is oozing blood or not. Now, this issue is very important. Why are these issues important? Let's turn to the next page. Let's turn to page 3 for a second. In the Nishmas Avram, you have a comment by Rav Shlomo Zalman. Rav Shlomo Zalman Zatzal makes the following comment. Bekasaf li hagoin Rav Shlomo Zalman Orba Shlita. Is everyone with me? Ba'af agav shemakam otzi adam, gamma oso gidim shemakim b'shas av eses, v'kol makam dam nida hu rak adam shiyotze me'elav kedarko ba'ofen tivi. In other words, he says an unbelievable, he says this is a critical piece.
Just get you to a, he says like this.
So, let's say there is, let's say I do some type of test and I rub against this endometrium lining and all of a sudden I'm showing blood. I rub against the endometrial lining for any one of the tests I just showed you in which that would happen. Let's say to check if there's endometritis. Or I rub against there because of other tests that I didn't show you. Or, so what happens is like this. A woman, it's during her clean days, all of a sudden she's starting to spot. So, according to the Ramah, if she has a maka ba'oso makom, so the maka ba'oso makom, you have to know for sure that it's oozing blood. If you don't know it's oozing blood, then maybe the woman becomes a nida again. It's very hard to become pregnant if you're a nida. So, as I mentioned before, the Rashba says that you don't need to know for sure that the maka is oozing blood. As long as there's a chance that it might be oozing blood, that's good enough. But let's follow the Ramah. The Ramah says that if there's a maka, but also makom, you're tola, and you know, and there's a chance that the maka is expelling blood, you can be tola on that. What Rav Shlomo Zalman wants to remind us is the following. You might think that this is the exact area which, again, if you remember, I said the word sloths is off to create the nida. This grows, and when there's no pregnancy, it removes itself. That creates the menstruation. Now, if I make an incision here and take a piece of this off, you might think that's nida. It's coming from the same location. Location. It's coming from the same location. So Rav Shlomo Zalman is bifurcating the not the location, but the reason why the blood has come out from the location. What Rav Shlomo Zalman is saying is that if the blood is coming from this location, not because it was hormonally induced, but because there was an external stimuli that did it, because I scratched it off, that does not create the status of nida. That's an extremely important point. It basically is saying, Rav Shlomo Zalman is stating, that any time in which I'm involved and I create a bleeding because of a test that I've done, any type of reproductive test that I've done, so since the blood has been created because of a test that I've done, that does not create the halos shem of nida. Yes?
Rav Shlomo Zalman says this conclusively or says maybe?
No, you have it in front of you. What do you tell me what you think he says it conclusively or maybe?
That only in the case where she has a regular...
No, Rav Shlomo Zalman is saying no. Rav Shlomo Zalman is saying I didn't need to bring you Rav Shlomo Zalman. If it's the Vesis Kavua, then he's not adding anything. He's trying to tell you if you know that the person is doing a procedure. I'm using procedural words. It's not what he uses. There's no source that I'm going to talk to you about that I haven't given you. If you know for sure that the blood is coming from this area, that you created it. Because of Leah Governor Shlomo Zalman Orbach Shlita, Afagav Shemakam Otsia Dam Gama Oso Hagidim Shemafakdim Mishasav Eses, Mikomakam Dam Nida Hurak Hadam Sheyotse Me'elav Kidarko Ba'ofen Tivi. All right, we have to deal with the Sichas Kever issue in a second. That's a different halachic thing. We'll get to that in a few minutes. Yes?
I'm not clear on the distinction between this and between what Shlomo Zalman is saying and the normal understanding of Dam Maka and the Makkah.
It might be the normal understanding. I'm just starting from point zero.
I mean, might it be that if without this Rosh Hashanah, we would say that Dan Maka is only
from
on the inner os?
Dan Maka is from over here.
But from the Makor. But it's coming from the U.S.
Dan Maka might be simply if... Sorry?
A bleeding fibroid.
Right. Well, a bleeding fibroid might be a problem because it's hormonal, might be hormonally induced. That's actually Rav Forst in his book, Anida, if you look at the first publication, writes that a bleeding fibroid has no problem. If you look at his last publication of it, he writes that it is a problem because now the medical research shows that it actually, the hormones can sometimes cause that bleeding. But Rabbi Schwartz's idea is 100% correct. If there is some type of growth in this area, a tumor that's causing it to bleed, but not from the uterine lining, but from some other location in here, a growth of some sort, that might be what Dan Maka is.
So
he's expanding the bandwidth of Dan Maka to say Dan Maka can be in the same location that hormonally induced nidus comes from. But it is not considered nida if it is not based on hormonally being induced, but it is based on an external stimuli, a maka of some type. In our case, when you're doing these tests that I just showed you earlier. Is everyone with me? Okay, let's go to the next page. Now, this can be a problem because a lot of times when you want to check for issues of infertility, you're doing it when the woman is actually during her Shiva Nikiyam. Why is that? Because that's the time in which the uterine wall is the cleanest. If the slothiness happened, it's the cleanest time. Ovulation is just about to happen. It's the best time to get the best picture. So now I'm trying to, you know, link the silos. I'm trying to explain to you why I gave you the medical stuff. Because a lot of times the vedikas will happen at that time. So Rav Vosner reminds us the following. What happens if during the Shiva Nikiyam, she starts bleeding? Because then they wanted to do some of the tests. They wanted to do the hysterosalpingogram or the laparoscopy or something else of that nature, and they put some type of probe in there, and they did it during the Shiva Nikiyam, because that, again, is the best time to do some of those tests. And all of a sudden, she's bleeding, so it's during the Shiva Nikiyam. Or how does she go to the mikveh? All of a sudden, she starts bleeding. So Rav Vosner writes, "Achron nevelku echta says zayin nikim with him achar duvedika yotzei dam." And he goes on, "Chazdas avne meluin hechmira the hefsei tahar duvedika achas b'yom rishon shazayin nikim yu nikim legamre. You have to be totally clean. Ubishut chasam sofer kasav the saga the hefsei tahar yenaki. That the most important thing is the hefsei tahara. The hefsei tahara balik boash in this tamamaka. The hefsei tahara basically breaks the chazaka that she's tamed." Even though you can be told since she is still in the status of nidus, and kambirur shahamakar nista. How do we know this is coming from the maka? It could be hormonal blood. She's a nida at this time. There it's just the din and birur, the hashta lekadam. Vedikos mamish b'zayin nikiyim, ela in tassim leiv zman ma b'chol yom ha'zayin nikiyim she'in shum hargasha shal p'tichas ben ha'maka or zivas dam lach, then it shouldn't be a problem. So my point is like this. My point is that the woman now, you do the vedika, she's in the middle of her, she hasn't started her zayin nikiyim, they tell her to go for a test. What do? So Rav Vosner writes, and it's in the normal psak, that minimally she needs a hefsek tahara. It's probably the first of the Zayin Nikiyam also, in order to start the process that she's now b'chetzas tahar. So what happens, what you do in that case is the following. The first thing you can do is basically try to see if you can push off the test today. Or what you can do is the following. If the test is happening in the beginning of the Shiva Nikiyam, what you can ask the OBG, what you can ask the nurse to do, or something of that nature, is the following. The woman goes the night before. Let's say you're worried. The woman goes the night before, and the nurse does her own vedika. How does she do a vedika? She takes the speculum, she looks inside, and she sees where the blood is coming from. If she can see the blood is coming from the maka, and there's blood coming from nowhere else, then she has created her own bedika by just a visual bedika. Or if she takes a cotton swab and she pokes all around this area, she does her own bedika, which is a much better bedika, one second, than the standard type of bedikas. You wait until after shkia, after tseis, you wait till after tseis, and which is, you know, that much time later, and then you ask her to do another bedika, and what happens is you have your hefsek tahara, then you have your first bedika. In other words, if there is going to be tests, or if the vaginal air, if the uterus, because of these tests, is very soft, so that you're afraid that by doing the bedika you're going to create blood, or if the following thing has been happening, that the woman has been trying to do a bedika, and she has been creating more blood, and by postponing when she goes to the mikveh, is a form of infertility that can be chas v'shalom caused by going to the mikveh. Sometimes you can exacerbate and postpone because you do bedikas that create blood. There's another way of creating. There's another way, and all the poskim speak about it. Well, I'll show you in a few minutes. There's another way of creating a bedika, and that is that, as I mentioned before, you go to the doctor, the nurse goes to you go to the doctor or nurse. The doctor or nurse does the bedika for you. That does the hefsek tahara. You wait till that says, and you and then you do another bedika, and you have your hefsek tahara and your first bedika. Why is this important? It's important because, as I said before, if you're about to go through certain tests, this can be a way in which you make sure that after your 7 and 5 days, you've essentially expedited the bedika process, so you're in the cheskas tahar instead of being in the cheskas of tamei. Any questions on what I just said? Yes, please.
Just a question about Nehemiah's. By nursing doctors,
yeah, we constant that they have even non-Jews, at least the way I was taught in Mechon Pua, that there was Nehemanis. They understand the reasons, yes.
In all these cases are coming where a woman comes to you and says that she saw blood and she had a gynecological procedure, and now she's asking whether you can be told that.
Sometimes it happens like that, or sometimes what happens is, as I said earlier, the role of the rabbi. Women, when the couple starts having problems of having a child, sometimes they'll look to the rabbi for guidance. In the New York area, sometimes the doctors will go over and say, you need to speak to your rabbi about A, B, and C, because they're sensitive about these issues. Sometimes in an out-of-town community, when they do certain procedures, which we haven't gotten to yet, there'll be a conversation about the fact that sometimes, because of the way they regulate the hormones, all of a sudden the extrapolation of eggs or follicles will happen on Shabbos, and there could be an Isidar Raisa. But if you don't do the removal at that point in time, a woman's life could be in danger. There are many points of entry in which a Rav will be asked questions by a couple going through challenges of infertility.
Like the Ramah, he's saying that you can be told that about Maka when someone just comes to you with like they have a kesem and they want to know.
No, you can't be told about Maka automatically. You have to check if it's a real Maka. You can't, or else there would be no shilas whatsoever. You have to ask the woman, is there a reason? Like if I when I get a Mara, if I see it's bright red, I'll ask the woman, are you feeling any pain? Are you feeling anything? Things of that nature. She'll say, oh yeah, I had an endometrium biopsy. I said, oh, okay. Why don't we call the doctor just to make sure that endometrium biopsy we could. I know 99.9% that they can give up blood, but I'm not going to take the chance. We're going to call the doctor. You'll ask the doctor. Okay? Or what will happen is, a question that came up. I was in Toronto yesterday, so between means, a guy calls me from Long Island. My wife had spotting. I said, what'd she have spotting from? Well, I'm not really sure. So I said, well, why don't you ask her and call me back? She calls me back. She says, we're having difficulty having children, and what's happening is they harvested eggs from her, and when she got up on the chuck, which is that like piece of it's like a very large, it's not a Band-Aid, it's a very large bandage that basically is put underneath her so that when she doesn't get the whole bed all bloody or dirty in any way, she saw spots on the chuck. So the Shom Shaila is whether the chuck is Mekabotoma or not Mekabotoma, whatever. Before you go on to that, I said, you mean they harvested eggs from her. So why don't you ask the nurse or doctor if normally there could be some spotting afterwards? So they called the nurse and they said, of course there could be spotting afterwards. That's Damaka. It's Ma'oso Makam, but it's Damaka. She's in her clean time. But if there was none of those issues, then it's not so pashit that it becomes an issue thing. And the other time is when you get a bedika, a lot of times the bedika, most of the time the blood will be stained all over the place. Sometimes, interesting, the blood will be stained and there'll be a middle that's clean, depending on how the blood looks or the mara looks, it actually could be a sign of infection. Or what could happen is you get a mara and it's just, there's one little spot, one spot in one location. And there, it's a lot of times, that's normally from a damaka. Because when the woman rubbed around, all of a sudden in one space when she did the rub, there was a place in which she hit that was the maka, and when she rubbed it, and it hurt it, or it was sensitive, and that's how you got the blood. So you have to look at, but you ask questions. You investigate, and then you come to closure together. But if you don't have anything to be told on, you can't be told on, especially if a woman does not have a vessus kavua. And most women do not have a vessus kavua. Any other questions? Yes.
Chazal write that now we don't differentiate between different colors of red, right? So when does that apply? Because I guess not in.
Well, you know, we do differentiate between different colors of red. We don't differentiate between different colors of red, but if you're sensitive to the nuances of it, you know when you see something bright red that there's a question that needs to be asked here. I wouldn't use that as my litmus test. Rabbi Nachum Bernstein makes a joke that there are some poskim that have, their definitions of yellow are so reddish that when they get stopped by police and the guy stops and went through a red light, he says, "What do you mean? It was yellow, right?" But there's a normal bandwidth of red, but there's dark red, there's a brownish red, and there's a bright red. If I see bright red, I know. That's a pointer to me that there's a pretty good chance that in the vaginal area is where the bleeding is coming from. I won't answer this. I won't say tahar on it. I'll say you need to go to an OBGYN and check. And 99% of the time, it's because of that. But you have to still check. That's what I meant by making that difference.
Okay. And also, do you mind just re-explaining it and understand?
Sure, please.
You said when the nurse would do the bedika for the woman, when would that take place?
Sometimes it's hard for a woman to get a clean bedika. Mm-hmm. And especially when you're about to do an infertility procedure, you don't want to waste the time, because once she does the infertility procedure and you don't have that first bedika, the infertility procedure could cause bleeding, and if you haven't created your chazakah, or ended your chazakah of tameh, you're going to extend the times where the woman can go to the mikvah. So in those cases, you can send a woman to a nurse, and she can do the bedika for you, for the woman, by just poking around in the area of the makor, putting a Q-tip over here, or looking herself and seeing if there's any blood coming out. That becomes a visual way of creating a bedika. In the article, in the end of this, there's an article that I wrote in the Journal of Contemporary Halacha. I discussed this issue. It's on page 35 of the article on this issue. Yes?
Why is it necessary in that case for the nurse to do the bedika? Why can't the woman just do the bedika herself and then she'll know that she's clean?
Because what will happen normally is when a woman does the bedika herself, she'll use a cloth, and sometimes that cloth will irritate that area. A nurse can do it in a much more sensitive way. And therefore, it can expedite the process of doing these things. That's why. There are some times where the woman herself, in her nervousness and things of that nature, will create the continuity of the nidus issue. A lot of times when young couples get married, the first few months, you'll find that as an issue. It's not a big deal then, other than the mitzvah of onah, but the point is, at these times where there are infertility challenges, postponing going to the mikvah can help, can miss the point in which you release the follicle, which means you can compromise the capacity to get pregnant. Yes.
What is the reason that there is no onus for non-Jews on this issue?
I mean, I can email you the sugyas. I've gone through this stuff, but
is this specifically medical personnel, or this is a sheet that they have in general?
This specifically in the research that I've done on this, it's medical personnel. It could be more expansive, but I don't know the answer to that. Okay, we're doing okay. Okay, let's go further. Okay, so let's go to the next sugya. What other issues could happen with reproductive technology? And that is that sometimes you will put some types of probes in here, which causes the cervix to be dilated, which is known in halakhic terminology as what? The psichas hakever. What is psichas hakever? Let's turn to page 4 of our handout. So the Shulchan Aruch, the Gemara, speaks about psichas hakever. The responsibility, even when a woman miscarries early on in the pregnancy, to bring a carbon based on lefishi of shabtichas kever below dam, and goes on in the Shulchan Aruch paskins hamapelas betoch mem inu choshesh lavad ama choshesh mishum nida afilu lo raasa b'pnei she'i of shabtichas kever below dam. Once the uterus is dilated, once the cervix is dilated, then we assume, even if you saw no blood, that there has been blood that has come out. But the paradigm of the Gemara is speaking about when the cervix is dilated and expands because of what happens in the uterus, right? Hamapeles. There was something in here. She miscarried. It came out. You saw no blood. But it was dilated by something that happened internally. What is the halacha when the, let's turn to the next page. What is the halacha when the opening of the uterus is not due to an internal stimuli, the ideal that the Gemara speaks about, but based on an external stimuli? I don't dilate the cervix because of something that's happening here. I dilate the cervix because I have forced it open. A woman, Rahman al-Tzlan, has a miscarriage. And it is not at a term in which you force the woman to go through labor. But there is placenta material and stuff like that you need to clean out. Or a woman has a problem, a reproductive problem, where when she has her period, the walls of the lining don't slough off totally. There's still a little bit of the previous lining still there. And every single month, a little bit still remains, and a little bit still remains, to the point where she's bleeding all the time because she has all this extra stuff hanging on the endometrium linings. And so what they do is called a DNC, which means a dilation, dilating the cervix, and a curettage, from the word correct that you asked me to spell, because I am cutting off the material that is on the endometrium lining. So in certain cases, I am expanding the cervix. And let's say there's no blood that comes out, but I'm just expanding the cervix because of certain procedures. What is the status of the nida in that case? That is a conversation that the Noda B'Yehuda has, and then the Chazon Ish has, regarding the issue of external stimuli causing psichas hakever. And while the Noda B'Yehuda pretty much says that external stimuli creates psichas hakever, the Chazon Ish leaves it with a tzarech ian. He's not 100% sure about this issue of a tzarech ian l'maisa. Again, we don't have the time to read all of the makoros inside. It's here for you. I've just told you basically, I even underlined the parts I'd like you to look at. It's summarized in an article at the end of the handout that I gave you on this issue, and footnoted by other poskim who discuss this issue, so you should do your own research in addition to what I'm saying here. But that's the issue. With that in mind, we pass in the halacha that any time you dilate the cervix, internally or externally, you create a status of nidus. The question becomes, how big a dilation does one have to create in order for there to be a psichas kefer? So, to carry on the karet issue, and I'll leave this for you. I did not put this on the CD. Here is a karet that is, I had it measured with a ruler. This karet is less than 3/4 inch wide. Just keep that in mind. And we can show it, or we can do the show and tell a little bit later, but it's less than 3/4 inch wide for those who can see it. And you can see the inches there. Why is that important? Because if you look at the tshuva of Rav Moshe Feinstein in his conversations about what is the definition of psichas kevim b'chutz, recognizing that it's not a slam dunk that there is such a thing as psichas kevim min achutz, Rav Moshe Feinstein writes that psichas kevim min achutz has to be l'chein yesh lahakel, the instrument she'avav pachos me'etzba ha'samach la'agodeh da'havei gimel ravei inch be'erech. Anything less than 3/4 inch, according to Rav Moshe Feinstein, is not considered psichas kevim. So that means if I use this type of probe in a woman and I do not create bleeding, and even if I create bleeding, I have not created nidus. Why? The bleeding I've created is because of this probe rubbing against the side, and I have not stimulated, I have not expanded the cervix. Not everybody follows Rav Moshe Feinstein. The Shulchan Aruch seems to indicate, other poskim things seem to indicate, that even 3 millimeters, which I'm not sure anyone here ever remembers, but if you look at the Parker pen refills, it would be the thin piece of the Parker pen refill, or it would be 3/32 inch. That itself, which this is, that itself would create a dilation. So for the Sephardic poskim, using this instrument would create nidus. For the Ashkenazic poskim, using this instrument would not create nidus. This is not just a Sephardic Ashkenazic thing. This idea of psichas kevim mibuchutz is a machlokas that's found in a whole bunch of things earlier than even the Achronim. And again, it's footnoted in the article that I wrote. And since I wrote it, I don't feel the need to show you all the makoros. Just to show you, I know the makoros. They're in the article. You can search them, you know, on your own. I just want to explain to you that issue. And therefore, it's important. Rav Moshe Feinstein actually is based on a Shiltos in Parshas Tazria, and where in the Shiltos in Parshas Tazria, it seems that Psichas Kefer needs to be the size of an embryo that's 40 days old, which medically is somewhere between 13 and 21 millimeters, which is 3/4 inch. So what we have seen heretofore is two different components of the issue of the halachic issues we need to deal with. Issue number one is what we would call damaka. We've discussed the issue of damaka. We've mentioned the challenges thereof. We've mentioned the case in which there is a woman who's going to go through a procedure that will create damaka. We mentioned the issue that sometimes it can postpone the capacity to go to the mikvah, which when you're trying to get pregnant can be a real challenge. And we talked about the issue of psichas kever and the recognition that there is psichas kever mibuchutz, but there's a machlokas amongst the poskim about the definition of what that psichas kever is all about. Now there are some other halachic issues that we need to discuss regarding the notion of reproductive technology. Let's go through those other subjects. First of First of all, does anyone have any questions? Does everybody understand what I've done till now? Everyone good? Okay. So let's go to page 7 and 8. Page 7 and 8 introduce the issers. The first source on this is a nice philosophical source. The idea, it's a famous machlokas between Turnus Rufus and Rabbi Akiva. The Rav had an unbelievable shtickle Torah on this feast. Rabbi Schwartz, you go till 2:30, right? What?
Yeah, I mean, you could have until 40.
Okay, good. Well, I could definitely use extra 10 minutes. Okay, so in that case, I'll spend 3 of it on this philosophical piece. And that is, Turnus Rufus says to Rabbi Akiva, you know why the Jewish people are condemned to Gehenna? Because they help the poor. Suppose an earthly king incarcerated one of his subjects and said, you cannot, no one can give the person anything to eat or drink, and someone snuck food into him. Would not the king be angry? You, the Jewish people, are considered servants of God, as the Pasuk says, Kili b'nei Yisrael avadim hei. All right? So Rabbi Akiva says, suppose an earthly king incarcerated his son and said, no one should give my son food or drink, and someone snuck food or drink into the son. Would not the king be happy? And we are called the children of God. So Rabbi Soloveitchik once said, and actually Rabbi Dr. Tursky, Rabbi Meir Tursky's father, Rabbi Dr. Tursky Zatzal, wrote in an article in Tradition on issues of welfare. He quotes this conversation, and he explains the following. What is the argument between Turnus Rufus and Rabbi Akiva? It's how you look at the world. Turnus Rufus says, God made this person poor. We wear the glasses of a Kadosh Baruch Hu. That's what it means to be God's partners. If God made this person poor, you have no right to feed him. If God made this couple, if God created a situation where this couple cannot have children, you have no right to change the status quo. Rabbi Akiva says, we don't wear the glasses of a Kadosh Baruch Hu. If God made this person hungry, we have to try to imitate a Kadosh Baruch Hu. Mahu rachum, afata rachum, etc., etc., etc. This is not a plug for the CJF various programs. But the bottom line is that we don't wear the glasses of a Kadosh Baruch Hu. We don't take a providential view on things. We are a Kadosh Baruch Hu's junior partners. And if we can change the status quo for the better, we should try to do so. That's exactly, says Rabbi Soloveitchik, what Rabbi Akiva said, the capacity to be able to change the world around us. That's true when it comes to issues of infertility. God has given us, Kadosh Baruch Hu has given us the gift of science. It's not mandated that a couple do it. You know, after 120 years, we're asked a whole bunch of questions. Sipita li Yeshua, right? Did we treat business in an appropriate way? And it says, asakta b'piriyah v'rivya. It doesn't say kiyamta period berifia. It says asakta. The mandate is not to have children. The mandate is to try to have children. That doesn't mean you have to take heroic activities. A person who whose siblings have been killed or through issue of bris mila does not have to agree to engage and undergo a bris mila in order to be able to eat the carbon pesach. You don't have to do these measures, but these measures are here. And if should a couple wish to do them, they are very challenging, they're emotionally difficult, as well as physically difficult, and one should recognize there are those capacities. What are some of the halachic issues involved? Let's look at one of them. And that is, let's say all of the different issues we've talked about here have been done, all the ones, laparoscopy, hysterosalpingogram, all these things, giving the woman the medicine she needs, and they're still not having children, and now they need to go to the man, and they want to check the sperm. How do they check the sperm? First way is the PCT way I told you. After they have relations, they check the sperm. That's not a good way. There's no good doctor that's going to tell you that's the best way. It's the way every rav encourages first, because it's the easiest way, halakhically. But doctors will turn to you and say, I didn't get a clear vision of the sperm. And we have a halacha, if you ask a man to express his sperm on his own for you know, in ways that are not for a sexual relation, you see, Shulchan Aruch is pretty strong about that. What happens if you need to do get a sperm sample? What do you do? So Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva on this, where Rav Moshe Feinstein recognizes that in the first, Rav Moshe Feinstein says you have to do all the other procedures first. And that is, you have to check the women's procedures first. So Dr. Grazi and I, when we put together this PowerPoint presentation, we had a conversation on this, because he said that he would prefer doing a sperm sample first, because 50% of the problems are men. A sperm sample is much easier to do than half the tests I just showed you. But halachically, that doesn't work. First, you have to try to do everything to eliminate that it's the problem of the woman. Only then can you deal with the sperm, the sperm issue. So Rav Moshe Feinstein first suggests the following. He deals with this issue. If we count five lines from the top of the tshuva, from Hine Hadavar Hates, Sharofe Ratzos Bezera Habal, we're seeing them after he quotes Yuv Vamos, Barak Shiyish Od Isser Lo Tinach Biyad. He explains that there's an extra Isser, as the Shulchan Aruch says, of a man creating sperm by using his hands. Shalachain Asul Lahotzi Derech Mishmash Yadayim Mekalev. So first he suggests have a relationship with your wife, and then afterwards when you're about to have the relationship, when you're about to express the sperm, remove yourself and then place the sperm in another vessel so the doctors can check it out. Or another way of doing it is to use a condom. And that is not a condom that you buy in a store which has spermicide in it, defeats the whole purpose, but rather a condom that you get, a special condom that has no spermicide in it, and actually you put a hole in the condom, not in the front of the condom, on the side of the condom, because again, you defeat the whole purpose. And the purpose of putting a hole on, which Rav Moshe does not discuss here, and that is by doing that, you basically, it's still darko b'kach, it's derech b'kach, and sometimes that can work as a way of obviating the problem of total, what we would call moti shichas erev levatala. However, Rav Moshe Feinstein clearly indicates that, hey, this is not really moti shichas erev levatala, because what are you trying to do here? You're trying to have a child. That's not moti shichas erev levatala. Rav Moshe does say that you should wait 5 years before you do this procedure. But most people argue that Rav Moshe finds that medical procedures have become much more advanced, and we know when a couple's been trying to have a baby for over a year and they haven't actualized the dream of having a child, we know now, based on all of the more aggressive research that has been done since this tshuva has been written, that waiting 5 years is just going to mean you wait 5 years. Nothing's really going to change. So many poskim will suggest that once we know that there's an issue, you don't have to wait those 5 years. And therefore, the Tzitz Eliezer, and again, I was not interested in just amassing more pages, so I only gave you his sikkum, he writes the following. Let's look to page 8. Murta Labal, Latate Mishap Hazera, after La'avar She'isha Kvar Avra, Mitzida Al Bedikot. First, a woman has to do all her Bedikot, all the ones we talked about. And then we can let the Baal do a Mishap Hazera, Kidei She'yarofe Yamod Al Mifchan Im Sibas, if he's caused that. What's the reason? Maybe he doesn't have enough sperm. We'll give him certain medications. He'll have more sperm. Maybe he has no sperm. And then we can do what's called a fine needle aspiration, and we can remove sperm from one of his testicles. You can remove sperm from a man even after he's dead from one of his testicles, which deals with the issue of what we call posthumous paternity. Man dies, remove sperm from his testicle after he's dead, put it in a woman, she conceives. What's the relationship with the father and the child when the father was not even alive during conception? It's a child of Cohen. Does the child say, have yartzeit? The father died before he was conceived. Does he have issues of nachla? All those issues. My goal was to get to those by 2:40. Not sure we will. We'll do them next time. Right? What's the gore? And then he goes on, Hadera hakal biyoser pi alacha v'ashem elam maskim lahatir kima kol poskim sharofi yotzi zera merechem isha miyad la'achas shiyu yachad. What procedure is that, Bet? What procedure is that?
PCT.
Thank you. I was getting nervous there for a moment. And then if that doesn't work, because, and it says Eliezer writes, because beglala taruvos v'nei lechus, because there are all of these extra debris there, then you have to figure out, and he quotes Rav Moshe permits it, and Minchas Yitzchak and others, and therefore he discusses an issue of that the husband and wife go into a room in the doctor's office, have relations, and give and then give the spirit. That doesn't always work. That's a little psychologically trying, little sneeze challenges and stuff like that. It's actually interesting. B'nai Brak and Meir Sha'arim paskin differently on this issue, whether that's a preferred way or not. Different poskim paskin differently on this issue. I don't remember which group follows what. I tried to quote Rav Burstein this morning to remind me, but the bottom line is he acknowledges that that's not, you know, that can create a lot of psychological issues. And by the way, you should just know that, and I think that this is just shows the they have worked out a very tsnius way, which I'm not going to go fully into because I don't want to give away the tsnu away, and that is that to arrange for those who live in the Shtachim and other places, especially during the times of the terror attacks, where sometimes the roads were closed. So if you had relations in your house, and by the time you brought the sperm to the hospital, it was 3-4 hours later, and therefore the sperm wasn't worth anything to look at, that they had worked out with hotels where the husband and wife could have, you know, a room when they got to Yerushalayim in a way that not even the hotels were aware of what the reasons were, so that the tznius could be handled in the appropriate way. So these are the extra collateral damage challenges during an intifada when couples who live not in the main cities had to deal with some of these issues, like issues of testing for sperm and other things of that nature. He mentions the issue of what you can do. He mentions using the condoms. He mentions using other things of this nature. He mentions the fine nasal aspiration. And he indicates again, Yitzhak Eliezer's Shuvah was written a little later than Rav Moshe's, that this idea of 5 years or 10 years doesn't really need, because a filu pachos mizeh, even less than that, you can still do these types of procedures. So the first major issue is, how do you do sperm testing? We just explained it. You can do sperm testing by having intimate relationship with one spouse, having a condom, or removing before expressed, and they have it expressed in the tube that they would like it expressed in. And if nothing else works, even the Tzitzit Eliezer allows one to express sperm with one's hands in order to be able to fulfill the mitzvah of puru refu. Yes.
So therefore, I want to make sure I understand. Both Rav Moshe and Tzitzit Eliezer write that being dashmi pnim is only mechutz is mutter when there are infertility issues.
Yes.
Is it at all related to the fact that the Shulchan Aruch is so machmir with regards to that is because it may be from a source from the Zohar and not from other classical sources?
I don't know the answer to that question. I think it's pretty articulated. There's another issue based on that issue that we're going to get to in a second. And you'll hopefully remind me if I don't touch on it. Any other questions on what we just did? Okay, let's go on a little bit further. Okay, I think we should be able to get a little further. So I mentioned to you the idea that sometimes the cervical factor, poor PCT, might create the following issue. And that is, you know what? They'll say, you know, you, Mr. Plony, you have sperm, Baruch Hashem, but you don't have the millions you need. You only have a few thousand, or you only have 1 or 2 million, and not 5 or 6 million sperm. And we're going to be able to solve this problem in the following way. We're going to solve the problem by the sperm normally lets off right over here. Then the sperm has to travel, and it hits the fallopian, it has to travel into the fallopian tubes. So the sperm has to travel to right over here. Okay? Does everyone see that? This traveling from here to over here is a long distance. And the endometrium lining isn't as smooth as it looks here. it has a lot of hooks in it, which, you know, for New Yorkers, let's say, it's like traveling on the FDR Drive with a lot of potholes. So if you don't have enough sperm here, what will happen is none of the sperm are going to reach over here. So there's something called IUI, interuterine insemination. What you do is you say, hey, listen, the sperm should not have to travel on the FDR Drive. It's just not good. There's not enough sperm. So we're going to create a flyover, and that is we're going to park the sperm right at the doorstep of the fallopian tube. We're going to do what's called an interuterine insemination. We're just going to take the sperm that you put in that zuchuchit. We're going to clean it up, wash out any sperm that isn't so nice. And then we're going to syringe a whole bunch of them, and then we're going to put it in the woman right over there. And that's it. That's what we'll do. And all of a sudden, what happens is that it's much easier to have a child. Now, this can also be done, for example, let's say, so here's the two other halakhic issues that happen. They want to do this, and all of a sudden they see the woman is ovulating. It's time to do this. You're taking the ovulation test, Mrs. Cloney. It's time to do this. You took your ovulation test and you did it. We're not getting into the Shabbos issues of doing an ovulation test. We'll get to there. But all of a sudden you did this, and what happens is that the woman is still Anita. It's still during the Shevinikiyam. It's still during the 7 days. You can't have Bia during the Shevinikiyam. The question is, can you do this during the Shevinikiyam? There's no sexual acts that are happening here. Can you do this during the Shevinikiyam? Doesn't seem to be. Is there any issue of doing this during the Shevinikiyam? That's question number one. And question number two is, does this in any way delay going to the mikvah, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. Okay? The next piece of this is, sometimes what happens is, so what are the problems? Or by the way, ovulation induction can mean that there's two problems here. The woman is having difficulties. So you stimulate the her ovaries, they start ovulating, and again, it's during the Shevinikiyam. So the problem, one second, the problem with IUI is that it could happen without going to the mikvah. Or how do we know that they're using Mr. Plony's sperm? Let's say the laboratory decides, hey, I'm getting paid based on how successful I am. Mr. Plony's sperm is you know, between Baininess and Zaborius. I'm going to use Idia's sperm instead because I'm really getting paid by how successful I am. How do we make sure that they're using Mr. Plony's sperm and not somebody else's sperm? Because the definition of paternity, we'll see, is the sperm donor. Multifetal pregnancies, we'll get to it at a different time. Lest you think I'm joking about the Idias, Banias, and Zaburius thing, here's an article from the New York Times, which speaks about an embryologist who failed to correct his mistake, and thus he has many children of his own all over the United States. Because he had good sperm, his clients didn't have such good sperm, and so he was a trooper and lent out his sperm. Okay? So that's issue number one. The second issue is, let's say that doesn't work. So there's another form called in vitro fertilization, IVF. What IVF does is you take the egg from the woman, you take the sperm from the man, and you fertilize it in the laboratory itself. Here's the beginning of fertilization. Here's when it's four cells. This is called the blastocyst stage. Start off with the beginning, and please God you get till the end. Why would IVF be used? We talked about these. Now you guys should start understanding some of this. endometritis. It's been hard because there's been problems on the uterine wall. There's been adhesions. There's been tubal blockage. There's been other issues. And there's been male factors. And what is needed in IVF? Ovulation induction. You have to cause, you don't want to see, remember I said what happens is you, when a woman ovulates, she gets one egg. One egg is not enough. You want to make sure the woman, you retrieve a whole bunch of eggs. So you're going to cause a woman in an IVF procedure not to just have one ovulation. You're going to cause both ovaries to work and mature many follicles at the same time. So you can pull out 8, 10, 12, 14. The amount that it would take 14, the amount it would take over a period of a month, of a year and 2 months, you're going to cause them, you're going to ramp up the process. You're going to flush her with hormones like there's no tomorrow so that she has that. Then you're going to do egg retrieval. Then you're going to remove the sperm. Then you're going to create a culture where the eggs and sperm can come together. Then you're going to do embryo transfer. And then you're going to have some extra eggs left, and you're probably going to decide to freeze those in case they want to have more children or something else of that nature. So what has to happen? You create the cycles that I showed you in the beginning. You create the fact that the follicles, normally only one follicle matures. You're not going to have one mature. You're going to have 5 or 6 mature. You're going to give her injections of all different types to make sure that she is becoming a follicle-stimulating machine so that you can do this IVF cycle in a robust way. And then what you're going to do is you're going to go into the ovaries and you're going to pull out fertilized eggs. Unfertilized eggs. Follicles that have been stimulated. And then what you're going to do is you're going to take sperm and you're going to cause it to hit the eggs. And then hopefully you'll create an embryo, and at the blastocyst stage of development, you're going to take that thing and you're going to dump it into the uterus, and hopefully it will implant. And if the woman is older, or she decides to have 8 children, like recently was in the news, you might decide not just to deposit one, you might deposit a whole bunch more. How many you deposit depends on the age of the woman. If the woman's a little bit older, you'll deposit more. This becomes a little bit more challenging. IVF is also used when women get married later in life because the shells of the egg become tougher later in life, and therefore it's harder for the sperm to penetrate the shells of the egg. So as women push off getting married, IVF has become a procedure that is used in a little bit more. You'll see more of that being done. Yes?
Quick two-part question.
Please.
If you're implanting more than one fertilized egg, is that because you expect the other ones not to implant or because you want twins?
Or C, both. Sometimes they're not all will implant, or sometimes a woman wants to have not one but two. That's why a lot of times couples have gone through fertility procedures. It's not only because they've used Clomid, which is a way of forcing multiple ovulations, but also because of IVF, and they'll have more than one fertilized egg. But yes.
So the follow-up would be, I presume, in the larger world where a woman doesn't want to have septuplets or quadruplets, she'll abort the fetus. She'll abort the other ones that do implant.
It's called fetal reduction. They use the Lushan Saginaw. And by the way, in the world of fertility, they pride themselves not only on their success rate, but on not having multiple pregnancies for the reasons you just articulated.
So they don't have to do fetal reduction.
Correct, which is a very complicated procedure to do. Because again, the uterus is smaller than this. So you got to go in and decide, because you don't want to reduce all of them, because if you reduce all of them, they've just lost $15,000 and a whole bunch of time and a lot of pain and a lot of psychological challenges. Okay? These are all some of the other issues that go along with it. This is a standard fertilization procedure where you allow the sperm to attack the egg. The first sperm that gets there is the one that fertilizes. The other ones will stop. Or sometimes what will happen is what's called ICSI IVF. And that is you will not have multiple sperm do it, and it could be because the guy doesn't have enough sperm to play this game. You basically take the sperm, you put it in what's called a pipette or a needle, and you puncture the egg, frame of the egg, and you deposit the sperm in the center of the egg to force fertilization to happen. Why is it called ICSI? Because of its intracytoplasmic sperm injection, ICSI IVF, or a form of assisted hatching. This is just pictures of mom and shit happening. This is holding the egg in place. This is puncturing of it, as you can see from here. This is letting it out in the egg itself. Sources. That's my reminder to go back to halachos. Okay. We good so far? So let's discuss some of the issues here in the 10 minutes that we have left, and then we'll stop, and I think what I'll do is the community piece we'll find maybe another time, or we'll do it at another time, and we'll finish these pieces. Or maybe, okay, is that okay with you, Rabbi?
So March 5th will be
part two of this. Okay? Okay, yes?
You wanted to mention something about the Zohar?
I'm about to get to it. Okay. So the first issue is, I'm going to get to it. It's, hopefully I'll get to it. Okay? First of all, what defines paternity, what defines maternity? So I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the paternity piece. For two reasons. Number one, I have an article in the back here on that also. So I give you two articles in the back. One is an article by me on the gynecological procedures pieces, and then one is definitions of paternity and maternity. Just take it. I'm going to just show you. Should I give you both? Okay. Oh, I did. Okay, well, I'll bring next time the other one. So if you look at the page 9, there's a whole conversation here about what defines the father. So first you have the Megillas Esther that speaks about Esther, Ke'en La'av Ve'em, and then the same pasuk says, Ubamosa Viha Ve'ima. So the Gemara answers, what does it mean, Ke'en La'av Ve'em? Why the repetition? To remind us that the father died at the moment of conception, Nebuchadnezzar is still called the father. So if we see here, first of all, that the definition of being the father does not mean you have to be alive at the time in which you have raising the child. But we see in source number 4 the following question. Can a pregnant besula marry a Kohen Gadol? That's the Gemara's question. So the Gemara, Shmuel, says no, because I can show you how you could have intimacy without breaking the hymen, which is defined that the woman's a psula, and therefore it's not good. Yochol ani levo kama bi'ilos below dam. But however, the Gemara says no. V'chashinan shema ba'ambati ibra. That the woman was in a communal bath. She used the bath after a man used the bath. The man deposited sperm in the bath. And the woman, while she was washing herself, the sperm went into her, and she became pregnant. Now, we're not discussing the medical components here. The interesting issue here is the Gemara creates paradigms. And the Gemara is trying to separate the act of intimacy and the act of pregnancy to show that perhaps they should be viewed as two different components, and therefore suggest that a woman who's become pregnant and and is a besula can still marry a Kohen Gadol. The Beis Shmuel, Shmuel Fivish, paskins that, by the way, the father who deposited the sperm, who doesn't even know, what's the relationship? Has the father fulfilled the mitzvah of Pru Avu, or is the son related to the father? The Rav Shmuel Fivish writes that the Havei Beno L'chol Davar, it is a son for everything. And here we see the following. Giving sperm makes you the father. Nikuda. Enough. That's it. That's all you have to do. You don't even have to have the act of intimacy. Why is that important? Well, it's important for a few different reasons. And we're going to go through this, and then we're gonna call it a day. Okay? First of all, let's look at source number 10. I just want to quote to you the Rashi and Shabbos there, that when Shmuel says that we're Choshesh, Veshema, Ibra, Ba'ambati, it's not just l'chumra, but it's also l'kula. In other words, it's for all components that the father is the father. The second thing is, I want to show you the next piece. Look at page 11. Matzati b'hagos mag. I found in Hagos of the Sefer Mitzvah Kan, Yasha Mara Peretz, Shekasav Isha Nida, a woman who is having her Nida, Yechola Lishgava Sedide Bala. She can sit on the beds sheets of her husband, and his haros with Sedim Shishachon Ish Acher, but she cannot sit on the bed sheets of another man. Let the sperm there, she'll become pregnant from it. Va'amai, why are we not worried? Why are we not worried that she will become pregnant when she's a nida from her husband's sperm? Yavlad benida, and the vlad will be a benida, which the Zohar as well as the Gemara says is something not too good to become pregnant while you're a nida. Beheshiv kivan she'en kam bias iser. That's not a bias iser. There's no bias iser here. Havlad kasher l'gamrei. Afilu tisaber mishif chazer sho'acher. The answer is because with the man, it's not that we're worried that she is doing an act of an extramarital affair. We're worried about the following. We're worried about havchana. That what will happen is if she becomes pregnant from another man's sperm, everyone will think that this is a child not related to that other man. And Shema Yisa Basachoso, maybe they'll marry a relative, a sibling, or something else of that nature. This is a very important idea here. First of all, it says Masasi Vismag. If you look at the footnotes there, it says he checked the smag and doesn't say it there. And he's 100% right. It doesn't say it in the Sefer Mitzvah's cotton. But if you check the Sefer Mitzvah's Gadol, it does say it. So for all these generations, it's been been mistyped. So in the scholarly Shulchan Tour, so you have in the footnote on the bottom, Chav Zayin Lo Matzati, I didn't find it. Well, because it's not in the Sefer Mitzvah's cotton, but I checked it. It's in the Sefer Mitzvah's Gadol. We're going to get the Rabbeinu Peretz in a sec. So why is this important? Because the reason it is giving that the concern of her sitting on the bed sheets is not because there's any concern that by having sperm put into you without a sexual act is an extramarital affair, but because of the concern of Shema Yisa Basachoso. Why is that important? That's important because of two things. First of all, can you do this act of IUI, of depositing sperm in her when she is the cheskas nida? You cannot have relations when the woman is a nida. This Bach that quotes the smag, all right, is telling you depositing sperm in a woman's body is not a chetzah, doesn't create an isser. There's no isser there. Because the reason why I have no concern with her sitting on the bed sheets of when she's a nita is because I'm not concerned about any type of forms of sexuality, of sex when she's a nita. I'm not even concerned when it's the sperm of another man. Only for reasons of a chana, of Shema Yisa Basachoso, of keeping the yichus straight. What that does is, it gives you a window into the IUI situation, where let's say the woman cannot have, let's say you cannot create a situation where the woman can have the sperm deposited in her after she goes to the mikvah. She will pass ovulation. This smog, as well as Rabbi Hoffman said, in the Taz, quoting the Rabbeinu Peretz, in the name of it's the smog, and the smog says Rabbeinu Peretz. And again, it's not the smog; it's not the Sefer Mitzvah's cotton, but the Sefer Mitzvah's Gadol. That the only concern is Avchana Shema Yisa Basachoso. And by the way, the Tashbait says the exact same thing in source 13. Now, There is a Shilte Geborin which doesn't agree with that. The Shilte Geborin actually says, which is sort on page 14, that there is a concern. There is a concern when there isn't intimacy that even when there's no intimacy, there's a concern that when the woman sits on the bed sheets of a man she's not married to, that there's concerns about that type of relationship, even when there's no intimacy, that create a status of mamzerus. But why am I sharing this with you? Because that 99% of the poskim, or all the poskim, will allow an IUI to happen, an intrauterine insemination to happen when a woman's anita, because the normative issue is if there is no relationship, if there's no sexual act, the anita's issue isn't an issue. However, because of this das of the Shilte Geborin, we will suggest to the woman that if she's during her Zayin Nikiyim, she goes to the mikvah. When she goes to the mikvah, she then reduces the level of her nidus from nida d'oraisa to nida d'rabbanan. Then, what the Zohar and the Gemara are concerned about of a woman becoming pregnant when she's a nida, no longer is there. That does not permit chibuk and nishuk between the husband and wife. And therefore, only allow a couple that you know are scrupulous in these laws to do that, because you're being concerned about one shita, you might have them be involved in chibuk and nishuk. That's an issue. But I'm going to leave you just with one question, which we're going to answer. If this happens, if the IUI happens when the woman's during her Shiva Nikiyam, let's say it happens on day 6, when does the woman go to the mikvah? Happens on day 6, she does it, she finishes, does she go day 7 to day 8 to the mikvah?
No.
Why not? Good. Poleta Shivchazera. Poleta Shivchazera, you require 3 days after Shifazer is in the woman before you can go to the mikvah. Here would be an example of if an IUI is done during the Shiva Nikiyam, and it's done towards the end of the Shiva Nikiyam, sometimes you might tell the woman, go to the mikvah on the 5th day before you're about to have this. You can't do any chibuk and nishuk. And by the way, 3 days after you had the IUI, go to the mikvah again. But Rabbi, it's the 10th day, it's the 11th day, it's the 9th day, whatever it is. Yeah, because Poleta Shechazera requires that 3 days before you go to the mikvah. So those are some of the issues with the IUI. This is also the reason that Rav Moshe Feinstein writes that you need, if a man doesn't have sperm, and since it's the definition is the sperm donor is the father, that if you want, if a couple wants to have children and they want to... And the husband doesn't have sperm, and you've done everything that you can, then you can use sperm, but use sperm from a non-Jew. It makes the child a Yisrael, but even if the father's a Kohen or a Levi, but since it's better than using a Jewish sperm, because you'll have problems of Shema Yisa Basakoso, you won't know who the children are. And therefore, Rav Moshe says, use sperm of a non-Jew. That is what is highlighted in source page 15. This is where we're going to end. Okay, source 15. That Rav Moshe has this tshuva about using the sperm of a non-Jew. His house was firebombed for this tshuva, by the way. The Satmar community was not excited about this position, and the fanatics, not Satmar itself, let's not paint everybody with the same brush, had concerns about that. And Minchas Yitzchak on page 19 clearly indicates that when you do an IUI, the man is Yotze, the mitzvah Puravu, for all the reasons we already said. And that is, the sperm donor is considered the father, and he just warns you about making sure that you don't mix up the sperm. So that's the tshuva on page 19 through page 23. We're going to stop here, but I want to just mention one other thing to you, and that is on page 31 through page 43, you have from Noam. How many people have heard of Noam before? Okay. Rav Shlomo Zalman has a whole tshuva in here about a sperm donor. He writes an article in Noah. His house was not firebombed. How many people have heard of Igros Moshe here? Because Igros Moshe, everyone reads. Noam is not exactly the most well-read publication. And his tshuva is in here. He basically says the same thing as Rav Moshe Feinstein says on this issue, discusses a few other things. It pays to read it. We're going to stop on page 24, where what happens if the sperm, we're going to discuss a little bit about IVF and those issues, and PGD, which is another form of discussing issues of infertility, reproductive technology, and the next time that we meet. Okay? Okay. These are for you to have. If they don't work, you can return them at the CJF for another copy. And have a good day.